It is Monday, March 4th, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. And support for Ozarks at Large also comes from the University of Arkansas Women's Giving Circle. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, how a proposed voter ID law could affect Arkansans, insects' place in poetry, plus a conversation with the local fantasy author of Small Things. But first, the federal government has passed the deadline for making substantial cuts in spending and increases in revenue to avert sequestration measures. As a consequence, several state-level programs using federal grant money will feel the pressure of federal belt tightening. Brandon Sharp, the state's budget administrator, says that the state's Department of Finance Administration has been cautiously awaiting the sequester cuts.
We have instructed agencies over the course of the last several years that in the event of a loss of federal funds, that there would not be sufficient state funds to supplant those losses. And so they needed to plan that if an agency received a loss in federal funding, they would have to cut back the services for that program to match the available funding that they do have.
Of course, with the Arkansas General Assembly in session, Sharp says that action could be taken to help bridge the funding gap for programs that have had their federal funding diminished.
They could reallocate funding as they saw fit to address some of these program needs. But obviously, with the governor's balanced budget, that means that other existing programs would have to be reduced in order to make up the difference.
Sharp says that state programs that have had their federal funding reduced or eliminated are likely to be eliminated rather than propped up with funding reallocated from elsewhere. In addition, he says that the sequester won't impact Governor Beebe and other state officials' plans for a federally backed expansion of the state's Medicaid system, as Medicaid spending is exempt from sequestration cuts. The two public transit entities in Northwest Arkansas have announced a new partnership this morning. Starting today, Ozark Regional Transit's Route 40 and 47 will be altered to include stops at the University of Arkansas's Uptown campus at the former Arkansas Western Gas buildings on North College Avenue. Adam Waddell, the associate director of Razorback Transit, says that the trial program will help serve the spring international student population who attends classes at the Uptown campus, and that in this instance, it just makes sense for the two entities to collaborate.
We have several stops that are mutual or combined stops. This will just help coordinate stops better, specifically in this situation, along from the Northwest Arkansas Mall down to Hillcrest Towers near the Fayetteville Square. They have a route that runs northbound and southbound, and they're going to be able to pull those two routes onto Front Street there so they can stop at both northbound and southbound at Uptown campus.
Other stops on Razorback Transit's Red Route, now served by Ozark Regional Transit, include the Northwest Arkansas Mall and the Fiesta Square Shopping Center. Waddell says that the experiment will help both entities determine how else they can collaborate to better serve the campus community.
With this project going with the Spring International students, it's really going to give us an insight of where other university students may use Ozark Regional Transit to travel throughout the region. Fayetteville, Razorback Transit, we're centered here in Fayetteville. We don't go outside of the city limits at all. With Ozark Regional Transit, passenger could catch the bus in Fayetteville and actually ride it all the way up to Bentonville. So it's going to give us some insight as to how many other students may do that by using the kind of a test group with Spring International.
Students, faculty, and staff wanting to use the ORT buses will be able to ride the system anywhere in Northwest Arkansas for free, but they will have to show their Razorback ID cards to ride the buses. The Walmart Foundation this morning kicked off National Nutrition Month and National School Breakfast Week with $6.7 million in grants given to five national nonprofit organizations. The organizations provide children with school breakfast and help families develop better eating habits. Those organizations receiving money include Action for Healthy Kids, the American Association of School Administrators, Common Threads, the Gaston and Porter Health Improvement Center, and the National 4-H Council. The grants will help the organizations provide breakfast at school for more than 160,000 children in more than 100 school districts across the nation. Some of the grants will also go toward implementing nutrition education and literacy for low-income families and at-risk children. The Walmart Foundation is making other news this morning as the president of the foundation has been tapped by President Obama to head the White House Office of Management and Budget. According to the CityWire, Sylvia Matthews Burwell is expected to be officially named to the post by the president sometime today. Burwell was named president of the Walmart Foundation after serving for a decade in executive leadership of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. She has also spent time in Washington, as she was deputy director of the White House Budget Office during the Clinton administration. She has bachelor's degrees in government relations from Harvard University and in politics and economics from Oxford University. Speaking of nonprofit organizations, WinRock International has named its next chief executive. This morning, the Little Rock-based organization named Rodney Ferguson as its president and CEO, following the April 1st retirement of current CEO Frank Tugwell. Ferguson comes to WinRock International following a position at nonprofit-centric communications firm Lipman Hearn in Washington. His background also includes stints as a journalist at the Cleveland Plain Dealer and the Wall Street Journal. According to a press release by WinRock International, the organization has projects in more than 70 countries and throughout the U.S. Ferguson is set to lead a global staff of more than 1,100 people. The Razorback baseball team had a disappointing weekend. After losing to the Arizona State Sun Devils on Thursday, the Diamond Hogs lost Friday evening to the Gonzaga Bulldogs, 0-3. The picture didn't get any prettier Saturday when the Hogs lost again to the Sun Devils, 1-3. The Razorbacks finished their weekend with another loss yesterday when they fell to the Pacific University Boxers, 3-4. Hopefully, the Hogs' luck will turn by Thursday when the team opens a four-game series at Baum Stadium against San Diego State. Forecast calls for mostly cloudy skies in northwest Arkansas this evening, with a 20% of showers between midnight and 3 a.m. Overnight low around 32 degrees. Mostly cloudy in the Arkansas River Valley with a low of 40. Tomorrow, Tuesday, mostly sunny with highs from 47 in northwest Arkansas to 53 in the Arkansas River Valley. Clear tomorrow night with lows in the mid to upper 20s. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas. The Arkansas General Assembly is considering passage of a new voter ID law that will require government-issued photo identification to both register and to vote. Advocates claim it will suppress fraud, but some opponents say such laws tend to disenfranchise Democratic voters. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich spoke with the bill's author, a legislative opponent, as well as an elections rights expert about how such laws are trending nationwide.
Arkansas State Senate Bill 2 would require all Arkansans registering to vote or casting a vote to submit a government-issued photo identification card. Acceptable documentation would include a valid driver's license or state identification card, a military ID, U.S. passport, employee badge, public assistance ID, or college student identification card. A concealed carry handgun license will also do. Arkansas Republican State Senator Brian King, District 5, Green Forest, filed SB 2 2 weeks in advance of the opening of the 89th General Assembly, and he's worried about fraud at the polls.
I've been involved in elections for a number of years. I did serve a brief time on the Election Commission, and it's just been something that voter integrity is very important. If we can't trust the if we can't trust our elections, we can't put trust in the government that represents us. So it's very key, and we know that despite what the critics say, that there's not been voter fraud in Arkansas, we know that there has been voter fraud, and this is just a measure that will help protect the integrity of the elections.
Exempt from the law would be residents of nursing and long-term care facilities. A voter ID measure was first introduced back in 2007, before King took up the measure as state representative in 2009 and 2011. It failed all three times. But when he filed SB 2 on January 14th, it took only 6 days for the item to pass through the Senate and be dispatched to the House. Last Wednesday, it was a special order of business on the House Committee on State Agencies and Governmental Affairs agenda, where it stalled due to fiscal questions. Senator King has stipulated in his bill that it would not take effect until photo ID equipment was widely available at county offices to provide photo IDs for free to residents who don't have a driver's license.
Well, the Secretary of State, if they have the funding, they're going to provide the camera and the equipment.
Senator Brian King's estimated the cost to be around $300,000 to deploy photo machines to all 75 counties. But critics say that figure is not realistic and not sourced.
There is no appropriation, which is the worrisome thing about this.
Democratic State Senator Uvalde Lindsay, District 4 Fayetteville, says the Secretary of State's office currently does not have sufficient funds to accommodate such a law if enacted.
I haven't seen, and you know they're touting it, this is to keep voter fraud, but we've seen very, very few cases in Arkansas where a voter ID, a voter identification card, is going to suppress fraud. Yes, we have some problems with voting and some fraud, particularly as it pertains to absentee ballots, that sort of thing. And there's currently legislation being proposed to tighten up the laws regarding absentee balloting and how that's done. I think that's healthy. But obviously, Senate Bill 2 is out of the Senate with overwhelming support. And I'm just concerned that we don't do anything that makes the ability to vote more difficult for anybody.
Senator Lindsey's referring to SB 343, a companion election misconduct bill to deter absentee ballot voter fraud, which King's measure doesn't address. 33 states currently have some form of voter ID laws on the books. And according to the National Conference of State Legislatures, legislation is pending in 26 other states. 10 states have strict photo ID laws in place. A Washington Post poll last summer found that although nearly three-fourths of all Americans favor such laws, Democrats, more than Republicans, fear they will lead to voter suppression. Obtaining such credentials is more difficult for minority and working poor Americans who tend to skew Democratic. Conversely, Arkansas voter ID bill sponsor Republican State Senator Brian King prefers to cite Rasmussen polling, which also found nearly three-quarters of Americans in favor of such laws, but don't view it as suppressive. Ben Hovland is senior counsel with the Fair Elections Legal Network, a nonprofit, nonpartisan advocacy group based in Washington, D.C., that works to remove voting barriers.
Voter suppression around the country has sort of taken a number of forms. Certainly one of the things that's been one of the more popular efforts has been strict government-issued photo ID laws like you're seeing in Arkansas. But we've also seen reductions in access to election day registration in states that have that, reduction in early voting hours, various efforts that essentially make it harder for people to vote or take away other convenience voting options.
Hovland says forcing voting Americans to access government-issued IDs places an unequal responsibility on elders who no longer drive, transient Americans, working poor, and students.
And while some people may not view that as a large burden, you know, we're talking about a fundamental right to vote. And so any extra burdens that we're adding on people, we need to do so cautiously.
According to the Arkansas Secretary of State, to register to vote or to cast a vote, residents must present a driver's license, social security number, and if they don't have access to either of those, a current utility bill, bank statement, or government-issued check or paycheck, showing the individual's name and address. The Brennan Center for Justice, based at New York University School of Law, cites 11% of eligible voters lack proper photo IDs. Indirect costs associated with securing proper identification, center researchers say, are equivalent to Jim Crow-era poll taxes levied against African-American voters. And while proponents of such laws claim they will deter fraud, Ben Hovland said so-called impersonation voting is not the problem.
When you ask election officials if they have people who are showing up at the polls and pretending to be people who they are not, the answer is always a resounding no. People who run elections in this country know that people aren't showing up and pretending to be someone else. That's a felony. Certainly, even in the closest races, to make any difference, you'd be talking about committing, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, of felonies, and and generally people are not interested in that.
According to a 2012 News 21 study funded by the Carnegie Corporation of New York and James L. Knight Foundation, states reported a little more than 2,000 election fraud cases occurring since 2000. A majority of voter fraud, one-third of all cases, were absentee ballot. Corrupted campaign and election officials committed another 30% of fraudulent activity. Again, Ben Hovland.
And neither of those would be prevented by the photo ID law that has been offered in the Arkansas legislature.
Opponents to stricter voter ID laws tend to claim conservatives are sponsoring such ballot and legislative measures as a means to deter progressive votes.
I definitely think that people are trying to utilize these laws for partisan advantage, but I think that raises a very important issue, and that is, why have we moved in the direction of people using the law or the electoral laws to try to gain a partisan advantage? Rather, our election laws should be fair. They should be about ensuring that every citizen who wants to vote can vote, and that the parties or political parties and politicians should focus on creating a message or convincing their constituency that they deserve to be in office rather than eliminating people they think might vote against them.
Ben Hovland with the Fair Elections Legal Network says, in the end, Americans ought to be pushing legislatures to make elections more accessible and convenient. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Roby Brock with our content partner, Talk Business, has this Talk Business Arkansas update.
Where there was movement on Medicaid and tax cuts in the legislative session this past week, Governor Mike Beebe told state lawmakers that federal health officials have green-lighted Arkansas's request for flexibility with its Medicaid program and health insurance exchanges, a move that could provide billions of dollars to the poor and uninsured, as well as boost the state's health care economy. In short, the big takeaway from Beebe's meeting with Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius over the weekend was that Arkansas does have permission to explore using Medicaid expansion funds in its forthcoming health insurance exchanges. Medicaid expansion and the health insurance exchanges will begin in 2014. House Speaker Davy Carter sprinted through three House committees on Tuesday morning this past week, telling members that it was the start of the third quarter. He urged House members of the Judiciary, Revenue and Tax, and Public Health committees to take action on issues that would be in the best interest of the state. Carter told the Revenue and Tax Committee that he thought a $150 million tax cut package, anchored in a capital gains tax cut, was doable. He noted that it might start at $50 million and add $25 million in cuts per year in future years. Carter said the tax cuts were tied to Medicaid and health care reform in his eyes because, quote, the folks that are going to be paying for this are the job creators in this state and this country. A spokesperson for Axiom confirmed that the database giant has laid off workers as it corrects for market conditions. However, the number of layoffs represents less than 3% of the company's Arkansas workforce. Axiom said that less than 50 associates were laid off in Arkansas and less than 100 company-wide. Axiom employs more than 2,000 in the state, according to its annual report. The database and digital marketer has roughly 6,200 employees worldwide. Dillard's reported fourth quarter revenue of $2.15 billion, net income of $161 million. That was an improvement from the previous year's fourth quarter when the company posted profits of $141 million on revenue of a little over $2 billion. The company said it gained an extra week of sales due to calendar timing in its fourth quarter this past year. Same-store sales rose 3%. Now, for the full year, Dillard's profits hit $336 million. That is down from about $464 million in the previous year. However, revenue for Dillard's in its full fiscal year were $6.75 billion, an improvement from $6.4 billion 1 year earlier. Finally, Deltic Timber reported fourth quarter net income of $2.4 million compared to a year ago when the El Dorado-based firm posted a $200,000 loss. Improvement in its mill operations pushed the turnaround. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business update.
Support for Talk Business on Ozarks at Large comes from Bank of the Ozarks. Committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. Bank of the Ozarks. You have a friend here. More information at bankoftheozarks.com. Poetry uses words that are put together in such a way that evoke an emotional response through sound and rhythm. Poets choose their words to enhance their expressions. A word can be used literally or to represent a feeling. Nature is often used, including insects. Though poetry is a relatively new interest for Dr. Donald Steinkraus, he has always been interested in bugs, now seeking out their role in poetry. An entomologist at the University of Arkansas, he is also our Ozarks at Large insect expert. Dr. Steinkraus brought in some of his favorite poems, along with his wife Jane, who has always been interested in poetry. I began by asking him how he sees insects most often used in the poems that he reads.
Yeah, I think it's all over the place. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they're very accurate about their use of an insect. More often, I think there's a few errors as an entomologist I see in how they use the insect, but still has a poetical reason for being there.
It seems like often they're used as part of a metaphor, but then also, I mean, we brought a variety of different poems because some of them, they'll be part of a scene, like something that is part of a scene that someone loves. And then other times there'll be a metaphor for something that's going on in their lives.
All right, just another kind of broad question. I don't know. This is might be kind of silly, but as a doctor of insect study and a lover of poetry, what if you were to sit down and write a poem? How would you use an insect in a poem? Mm.
I actually have often written about insects in poems. Yeah.
Okay.
But I do look and watch for insects all the time, and I use them. Maybe as an analogy for my own self, when I see them die or if I see them singing, you know, I try to think of myself doing that. Some of the poets, like I have a poetry book by Issa, a haiku poet from Japan, and they really think of the insects as companions and friends. They don't treat them as like an other. You know, it's like you can be friends with an insect to some of these poets. So there's all different ways they've used these.
Do you want to look at one of them since
sure.
you've picked up the book?
Issa was a poet that lived in 1763 to 1827 in Japan, and these are translations into the English. Well, this one, I like this one because he treats the lightning bug as an old friend. Here it is. First lightning bug this year, why do you turn away? It's me, Issa. So he's telling the lightning bug, here I am again. There you are. Here I am. It's me.
It's summertime. There you are. Yeah.
Okay. So it's come back. There's a lot of good poems in here. Maybe Jane should read one.
Singing high, a cricket on a log floating down the river.
So, you know, what I like about that poem is, we're sort of all on a log floating down the river.
Yeah.
And the cricket is singing while he's floating down the river. And, each of us are going down that river of life, and it might be good to be a cricket singing on a log.
I like it. Okay. You mentioned that you have some other haikus.
These are by Taniguchi Busan, who lived in the 1700s, another Japanese. On a one-ton temple bell, a moon moth folded into sleep sits still.
That's sort of different. It's different than the other poet, yeah.
Yeah, I like that one. You know, to me, a moon moth is, if they've translated it correctly, is like our Luna moth. They're one of those big, long-tailed Saturniid moths. And they do rest. In the daytime, they'll sit quietly all day. And so I can imagine the poet saw this big moth sitting on the bell, and it was a beautiful sight, this calm moth on the bell.
Well, it's definitely a stunning moth, for sure.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. How do you think they get it so right? You said a lot of them get it really, really right on, spot on. I mean, are they doing their research?
Yeah, I think one is, I think poets are observers. They are observers of nature, especially those that are interested in nature. I think some poets are really interested in mankind only, and they don't use insects and nature in their poems. But like Mary Oliver uses nature all the time.
It's a kind of white moth. I don't know what kind, that glimmers, it does, in the daylight, in mid-May, in the forest, just as the pink moccasin flowers are rising. If you notice anything, it leads you to notice more.
The wings
and
of
more.
The moth catch the sunlight and burn so brightly.
At night, sometimes they slip between the pink lobes of the moccasin flowers and lie there until dawn, motionless, in those dark halls of honey.
Well, that, and it definitely starts out as, yeah, she doesn't sound like an expert necessarily. She's just somebody that's sitting in the woods, mm-hmm. you know.
Right. She doesn't try to identify
mm-hmm.
the moth, because she doesn't, and actually some of those little white moths are hard to identify.
Right. But just a white moth with glistening wings, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but she observes, she sees mm-hmm. it and makes an accurate observation about it. I think a lot of the poets just notice things. We have some poems by some really famous poets. William Wordsworth wrote about butterflies.
I love butterflies.
Do you? Should I read this one?
Yeah.
To a Butterfly by William Wordsworth. I've watched you now a full half hour, self-poised upon that yellow flower. And little butterfly, indeed, I know not if you sleep
Come
or
often
feed.
To us, fear no wrong. Sit near us on the bough. We'll talk of sunshine and of song, and summer days when we were young, sweet childish days that were as long as 20 days are now.
Now, what I like about that is he's welcoming the butterfly to his garden and saying, I want you here. I want you in my garden. I want to watch you. And a common theme I see in a lot of these poets is they know that insects usually only live a very short time.
Well, that's what I was going to say. What is the 20 days?
Yeah. He says here, sweet childish days were as long as 20 days are now. When you're a child, I think days are long.
Right.
And now as you get older, they get shorter.
I know. It's Monday again. Yeah.
Right. It goes really fast. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of them think of the butterfly as like, or the insect as an example of a short-lived creature that sort of signifies what human life is like, too.
So you mentioned that when you write poems, you kind of put yourself in them. They're, you know, you're the in, you know, you kind of use insects to represent yourself a little bit. Uh-huh. If you were to pick one insect that you compare yourself to, or even our Jane, which insects would you choose?
For me, it's a katydid.
I
love katydids. They're a very harmless insect. They are really important to me when they sing in the trees at night, and they're really beautiful and slow moving, and I just love to hear them sing, and so I often think about them and how they live, and most people don't really notice them as much as you'd think. They just hear the sound and they go on about their day, but they live a life just like we do.
Yeah. Okay.
How about you? What would you be?
I don't know.
Maybe a butterfly.
Now,
have you ever heard of a songwriter, jazz songwriter, bass player, singer named Esperanza Spalding?
Yes.
You know, she has a song, and this is a poem by William Blake that mm-hmm. she wrote word for word. She wrote Blake's poem, The Fly.
Into a song.
Okay,
and
how
it's a fantastic
awesome.
Jazz song. So this is by William Blake. And,
yes, I'm...
He's comparing a fly to us. Little fly, thy summer's play, my thoughtless hand has brushed away.
My thoughtless hand has brushed away. Am not I a fly like thee, or a thou man?
Life and strength and breath, and the want of thought is death, then am I a happy fly if I live or if I die. You know, I like that. He says, like, some thoughtless hand. You know, we thoughtlessly kill flies
right.
all the time. And he says, till some
swat away.
Until
yeah.
some thoughtless hand may brush us away, like a car accident. Or.
Do you have a favorite?
Well, we both love Jane Kenyon, and mm-hmm. I think that butterflies and moths. Moths are often seem to be associated in some way with death in people's minds, being because we mostly see them at night. And then butterflies with death and resurrection. And I thought this was an interesting poem that she wrote, I think when her mother was dying, although I'm not positive about that, but has a moth in it. It's called Reading Late of the Death of Keats. I tried to distract myself by reading late, but the rhythmic whir and puff of the oxygen machine reached me where I lay in the room that was mine in childhood. A huge moth bumped against the screen, tattering its wings. I turned off the lamp and lay all ears until it flew or fell away.
Aww.
I think she was sick at that time, too, wasn't she? She had cancer, I think.
She did, but I think she's listening to the... Well, maybe I'm wrong. I was thinking she was listening to the machine while her mom was dying.
But maybe it's her her own.
Not totally but sure.
Again, I like that. A huge moth. It's almost definitely either a sphinx moth, which are the hummingbird moths, or a Saturnian moth, and they are big.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it could be an underwing. But just interesting. You know, there's this poet, and in comes the moth, and I'm not sure exactly what she means by that.
It's bumping against the screen. And then she's lying there all ears until it flew or fell away. I mean...
Because you're laying there and you can't
and also
do anything
else.
Because
I think she's in the presence of death.
Yep. I'm sorry. Emily Dickinson used insects a lot in her poetry. So, and they're short. Shall I read a couple of her poems?
Sure.
Maybe Jane should read them. But a lot of them have to do with bees. This is by Emily Dickinson. The pedigree of honey does not concern the bee. A clover any time to him is aristocracy. That's a very short, concise poem, and she does make one error in it. She thinks the bees that gather honey are hims, are boys, and that's often a mistake people made over time when all the bees that gather honey are female.
Mm-hmm. The bees actually, I didn't think bees actually gathered honey, right?
No, they don't. They gather
nectar. Right, okay. Just making sure that my...
Yeah, they gather nectar and they turn it into honey.
Right.
But on the other hand, bees also rob. If a hive gets weak, honeybees will...
Well, okay.
...diligently rob their neighbor, and then they will be taking the honey.
But it's always the female bees that are gathering the nectar and the pollen... And
absolutely.
And then and also stealing the honey from the
that's right
hive.
And also defending the hive. The females are the ones that sting. They're the ones that do everything in the hive, except for a few little things that the drones do.
Okay, just wanted to make sure because it was like gathering honey, and I'm like, wait, hang on a second.
Just
making sure that my bee knowledge was on. Just making sure. One book that I brought in was one that I read as a child, but it's a lot more. It's a educational kind of thing.
I
don't
that
know.
Book.
I was looking at
there.
It, but it's for two voices.
Oh,
so
well, Jane
maybe
and you.
You guys,
no,
you guys need to read one.
No, you and Jane read it. Jane.
So this one's Water Boatman, and then you read it together, and then one person does stroke. We're water boatmen.
Stroke. Up early, rowing.
Stroke. We're coxswain calling.
Stroke. And oarsman straining.
Stroke. And six-man racing shell, rolled into one.
We're water boatmen.
Stroke. Worn out from rowing.
Stroke. Bound for the bottom.
Stroke. Of this deep mill pond.
Stroke. Where we arrive.
And shout the order, rest. The poem Jane Steinkraus and I read together is entitled Water Boatman. It's from the book Joyful Noise, Poems for Two Voices by Paul Fleischman. Dr. Donald Steinkraus is an entomologist at the University of Arkansas. He and his wife Jane joined me to talk about insects' role in poetry. This is Ozarks at Large. Bluebells of Scotland is just one of the pieces guest trombone artist Joe Alessi will be performing with the University of Arkansas Wind Symphony this evening at the Walton Arts Center. The guest artist stopped by the studio this morning to discuss tonight's program.
The one tonight, everybody's favorite with wind band for trombone solo is the famous solo Bluebells of Scotland. And Arthur Pryor was the champion of that piece. He wrote the piece. It's a theme and variations, and you have to do a lot of funny technical things, and it's always a crowd pleaser. And so millions of trombone players around the world play this piece. Maybe not millions, but thousands. And the other piece is a little Latin waltz that a gentleman, a British composer, composed the piece. We don't know much about the liner notes for that. There's not a lot of information about Mr. Cook, but it's another crowd pleaser. I might even say ole at the end of that piece.
In addition to performing with students in a concert tonight and tomorrow, Alessi will also teach private lessons, rehearse with both ensembles, and lead a two-hour music class for music majors.
I have to thank Professor Warren, and he's made me very comfortable here. And I think to come in and play with a group, if the conductor, the director of the band, it allows me to feel free to make comments and constructive comments and just to get the best musical result with the wind ensemble and together with the soloist, I think that's a great winning combination. So I feel very comfortable working with Professor Warren, and that helps a lot. So when you come into a new group, working with a group, it's you could tell the kids also that they're very interested in music making, and they're not there just to go through the motions of rehearsing, but they really want to make it better. I can see that in their faces and how they responded to, you know, to directions that they were given and, you know, during the rehearsal.
The University of Arkansas Wind Symphony and Campus Band will perform tonight, and the UA Wind Ensemble and Concert Band will perform tomorrow evening. Both concerts begin at 7:30 at the Walton Arts Center. Admission is $5. We'll have more from our conversation with Joe Alessi on tomorrow's edition of Ozarks at Large. Edgar Allan Poe remains one of the best-known American poets and writers, even though he died in 1849. Perhaps because so much of his writing involves themes of Gothic horror, early science fiction, and detective crime, Poe's death remains surrounded in mystery. Tonight at 6 o'clock, Stephen Barry, the Amanda and Greg Gregory Professor of the Civil War era at the University of Georgia, will discuss Poe's life and death. The talk is the annual Timothy Donovan Lecture, co-sponsored by the Department of History at the University of Arkansas and the Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the U of A. Steve Barry says tonight he'll discuss the last years of Poe, when he was consuming large amounts of alcohol.
And actually that's what the lecture in part is about tonight, is what it meant to drink yourself to death in the grand age of temperance. Temperance was a reform movement of Poe's period that was, you know, more important, or at least had more card-carrying temperance advocates than you had abolitionists or anything else. So drinking yourself to death in that age was a really big deal. So at the time, that made Poe a sinner and a depraved soul and all of these other things. Now it makes him Jim Morrison.
Poe, in both life and death, became a frequent target of the temperance movement as an example of wickedly bad behavior. Stephen Barry is writing a book titled Jingleman, The Death and Times of Edgar Allan Poe. It examines the last few years of his life after Poe became wildly famous for his poem, The Raven.
Well, once he published The Raven, I would argue that he's one of the most famous and then infamous poets in America. And I would argue that The Raven is one of the most famous poets in America. It was instantaneous sensation in 1845 when he published it. So by 1845, he's enormously famous. And by 1849, he's infamous and dead.
A previous Stephen Barry book, The House of Abraham, Lincoln and the Todds, A Family Divided by War, and his current work with Edgar Allan Poe were inspired by similar interests.
I had always been interested in Poe and Lincoln going back to childhood, and they are interesting characters to set up to. They're both born in 1809. They're both technically born in the South, or at least raised in the South in Poe's case. And they're both depressives. And So what they do with their depression was enormously interesting to me. Lincoln is somebody who wrestled with the demons of depression and learned to feel other people's pain and then goes on to be this sort of transcendent figure during the Civil War. Poe is a different character altogether. All of the pain he feels he wants to reinflict on other people.
Stephen Barry's lecture about Poe's last years and his death will begin at 6 tonight in Giffel's Auditorium in Old Main on the University of Arkansas campus. It is free and open to the public. The talk is the annual Timothy Donovan Lecture, co-sponsored by the Department of History at the University of Arkansas, along with the Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the U of A. He spoke to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums this morning. A longer conversation with Stephen Barry will be on an upcoming edition of Ozarks at Large. It is Monday, March 4th, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas, and joining me now is Becca Martin Brown. She is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
I just figured out something fun I could do.
Okay, what's that?
I could put the dates wrong on my little notes to myself.
And then totally
and
mess
just all
up,
week,
totally
y'all
mess
would
me
just,
up.
Yeah, huh? It'd be fun.
Now then the people know that we cheat and look at your thing to see what day it is.
Well, yeah, I cheat and look at my thing to see where I am and what I'm doing. But where I am and what I'm doing is going to tell you about a lecture by Michael Sorkin called Work on the City. If you've never been to any of these, they happen occasionally as part of the Faye Jones School of Architecture lecture series. They happen at 5:30 on Mondays in the Hembry Auditorium at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville. And they are always fascinating topics for anyone who has a love for architecture.
Okay.
That's at 5:30 and it's free. The University of Arkansas Campus Band and Symphonic Band both play tonight at 7:30 at the Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville. It's
$5. That's cheap.
And a band called Night Verses is on tour with bands called HRVRD, Let Live, Conditions, and Rescuer. I have no idea
we
who
don't know
these
what,
people.
We don't know what genre.
We know it's hard rock.
Okay.
And we know that Kevin Kinder says all this, our music writer, and we believe him. They perform tonight at 7 o'clock at the Showcase Theater at the Northwest Arkansas Mall in Fayetteville. Usually up-and-coming bands at the Showcase Theater. Tickets are $12 in advance at ArkansasLiveMusic.com or $14 at the door. And I believe those are always all-ages shows.
All right. Thanks, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
This Week in This American Life. Why do anything new? Let's face it, we love routine. We want things to stay the same. Reruns are more comforting than regular TV.
Last night, I was watching TV and I couldn't find a rerun anywhere. And I was like panicking and flipping. Oh, there was a rerun though. It was like a rerun of like The Nanny was on. And I don't have any relationship with it. So I was like stuck.
Live Stuck in Reruns this week.
This American Life with your host, Ira Glass, Saturday morning at 6 and Sunday morning at 10. Author Joe DeRoen resides in Northwest Arkansas. His book, Small Things, the first in a trilogy, was released late in 2012. He joined me on the phone from his home in Bentonville. I had read a review of Small Things that compared it to Stephen King, whose genre is horror. DeRoen says that Small Things is really more contemporary fantasy, but with some elements of horror. He began our conversation by describing that genre.
I guess as far as the contemporary part, it's set in our world. You know, it's not a Tolkien type of thing. As far as the horror goes, there are monsters and scary stuff and people dying. So I guess that's a correct description as well.
There seems to be there are a lot of trilogies coming out right now, and have been for the last few years. Do you know what's up with this recent surge in trilogies?
Well, mine started out as just an individual book. But I realized I had more story to tell, and I've already written the second book. I haven't written the third yet. As far as trilogies, I guess when somebody reads something they enjoy, they want to stay in that world. They want to read more about those characters. But as far as my trilogy goes, it will only be a trilogy. There'll only be three. I'm not going to continue it on past that.
And so then you know how it's going to end.
Oh, I do. Yeah. I do.
You mentioned that you didn't sit down to start writing a trilogy. But at what point in your writing process did you realize that there was more of a story to tell?
Probably about a year after I wrote the original one. I participate in something called NaNoWriMo, National November Writing Month. Each November, people are encouraged to sign up and write 50,000 words, which is a very small novel, but basically to get you going. And that's how Small Things came about. Then the next year, I wasn't sure what I wanted to write, and I realized I could tell more of a story, but it would take up more than one book. So a trilogy just seemed natural.
May I ask, your bio says that you are originally from Illinois. You currently reside in Rogers, though. So what brought you to Arkansas?
Okay, well, actually I come here by way of Dallas, Texas. I lived in Illinois until I was 16, and that's where the novel set, by the way, is Carthage, Illinois. Moved to Dallas, Texas, and then we moved to Rogers, I guess, about 8 years ago.
So you mentioned that you are from Carthage, Illinois, where the book is set. And also, in your bio, also I read that you collect Mego action figures. And within the first few pages of the book, there's mention of a Mego action figure. So is this book reflective of all of your childhood?
Actually, to a degree it is. I wasn't as old as the main character is in 1975. But I certainly remember growing up in Carthage, and I used a lot of those experiences. I collected, or I had Mego action figures then, and now I collect them. Of course, they're vintage now. But I did enjoy writing about that and including it in the book.
So tell me a little bit about the story and where the inspiration came from.
Okay, well, a lot of people, because the main character is a 15-year-old, and a lot of people think it's young adult, but it's really not. It's a book for grown-ups. Certainly teens could read it. The main character, Sean Spencer, he's 15 years old, and when he's away visiting his grandparents in Arkansas, then his best friend, Tanner, drowns at the Carthage Lake. And his younger sister, Jenny, who witnessed the event, claims that she saw a huge monster rise out of the lake to pull the boy to his death. And, of course, Sean doesn't believe her, but he's forced to reconsider when he realizes that he's being followed all over town by something that isn't quite human. And it turns out the monster's looking for something that it thinks either Sean or Jenny has. And the story unfolds both in real time and in flashbacks that illustrate just exactly what Sean and Tanner did that summer that somehow invited the monster into their lives.
Mm. So you say that Sean's grandparents are in Arkansas. Will we see the story? As an Arkansan, I have to, you know, ask and wonder, will it ever go to Arkansas?
Actually, it will in the second book and more in the third. And I've actually written some other novels, not published yet, that are set here in Rogers. And so I figure it's easiest to write what you know, and I now know the area pretty well.
Will we see some monuments or landmarks that we're familiar with in your future novels?
I'm sure there will be. Yeah, it's at Cambridge Park in Rogers, actually, some of the scenes take place there. I am a substitute teacher for Benton County School of the Arts, and I've renamed the school in the book, but I have some scenes taking place there as well. So I'm definitely using the local scenery.
So a monster chasing him. Is the monster, when you picture the monster in your head, is it something that we've maybe seen in other horror or fantasy novels? Or is this an original monster?
It's an original monster. It is. I intentionally, in the book, don't give it much of a description. You know, it's always in the shadows. It's dark. It's hiding. It can.
Yeah, I read something about red eyes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he has red eyes, and he's very dark, and you really have to. I mean, you mainly see him out of the corner of your eye, because I know that for most people, it's the things that they can't see that scare them the most, and I wanted the monster to be really scary.
Does Sean age as the trilogy progresses?
Oh, yeah, he does. The second book actually takes place closer to our time, and he's married and has a child, a teenager. And part of the story is about Ben, who is Sean's son. He's 19, I think, in the story.
I really want to ask if the monster follows through the trilogy, too, but that probably would give too much away.
I could say he does and he doesn't.
Yeah.
I'll leave it at that.
He does and he doesn't. Yeah, I don't want to give too much away.
Well, thank you.
So the second book you say is already written.
Yes.
And when will we expect to have that one published? And it's called Threads?
It's called Threads, and it should be published, planning on having it out probably by October of this year.
And the third, do you have a name for that?
I do not yet.
Installment?
Does not have a name. I have an outline written, and that's about as far as I've gotten.
So your career as a novelist, you have two more that are unrelated to the Small Things trilogy that you're working on.
Exactly.
Are those also in the contemporary fantasy genre?
Yeah, they are, and they're in the same universe, per se. I have some crossover characters, which I try to do. I enjoy that when I read it in other authors' work. You know, like you earlier mentioned Stephen King. He does a lot of that. And I like the continuity of using a character I've used in Small Things as a very minor character or sometimes a more important character in one of my other books. The two unrelated novels are both set here in Arkansas.
Are those, what stages are those in?
One is about 95% finished. One's about maybe 75% finished. I just need to do a lot of editing, you know, whipping things into shape. You know, that's the thing with writing. I'm sure any writer will tell you that probably half the battle is editing, because you're bound to have left some mistakes in there or not wrapped up a plot line. And editing it takes a while.
How do you go back and forth between working on so many projects at one time?
It's sometimes difficult. In fact, this last year, I wanted to participate in NaNoWriMo and write an entirely new novel, but I was also editing Small Things and getting that published, and I ended up having to drop out of NaNo because it just wasn't time enough to do everything, and it is hard to go back and forth. So I try not to really work on one thing or more than one thing at once. You know, maybe we'll work on a week on editing and then another week at writing, just so it's kind of more compartmentalized.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. DeRowan.
Well, I hope I've been entertaining enough.
Yeah, of course. Joe DeRowan's website is joederowan.com. His book Small Things can be found there at amazon.com. as well as Barnes & Noble. This is Ozarks at Large. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, and West Fork. Support for KUAF comes from Northwest Arkansas Media, publishers of Northwest Arkansas Times, Springdale and Rogers Morning News, Benton County Daily Record, and the Northwest Arkansas edition of the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, offering a blend of local, state, national, and international news, plus business and Razorback news. More information is available online at nwaonline.com. Support also comes from Bank of Arkansas, sharing in the vision of stability and strength of Northwest Arkansas's business community with a variety of banking services and the philosophy of long live your money. Bank of Arkansas. Member FDIC and available online at bankofarkansas.com. KUAF is your source for community events. Tibetan monks from India will visit Fayetteville for 3 weeks in March as they participate in several Buddhist ceremonies in Fayetteville and at the Buddhist Retreat Center in Madison County. For a list of events or for more information, visit artibet.com or call 479-530-3168. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Thomas. Antoinette Grajeda will be back tomorrow, Tuesday, for an all-new daily edition of Ozarks at Large. Thank you so much for listening, and have a good Monday.